Ladies and gentlemen, this is the QTR Podcast. Today is June 6th. God damn, we're in June already. That's incredible. 2018, and I am here again with the one, the only, Mr. Kenny Pulcari, live from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Kenny was on the podcast, probably 3 or 4 weeks ago now at this point, and was, if you haven't listened to that podcast, I would say listen to that one first, because Kenny pretty much takes us through the 1970s all the way up to and through, I think, 9/11, and what that was like on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And so everybody has been asking. Kenny had to jet during that first podcast. Everybody's been asking for me to have him back on. So I got back in touch with Kenny, and I got him back on today. What's going on, brother? How you doing?
I'm good. How are you? it's been a very interesting couple of weeks since we did last speak. But I think for the sake of the listeners, you know, we got to complete the one story so they get it, and we tie it all together, and then we can talk about, you know, whatever you want to talk about. But
I think where we left off was we had just gotten through 9/11.
Right. So the country was now at a standstill, right? Because what people need to understand, there was no plan B at the moment, right? Nobody who in their right mind could have imagined that. And the New York Stock Exchange was the central marketplace, so everything that traded here. And when that event happened, while the New York Stock Exchange itself was not physically damaged, we had become so dependent upon technology, because post the turn of the century, when we went through the market modernization, it was all about automated quotes, automated order delivery, handheld execution, the death of open outcry. All that it would have been fine, except when the exchange did that, you know, all the cables and wires that run every single server and computer down here, and the phone lines that, you know, that connect to the outside world, and the outside world that connects to us, all those wires ran through the belly of the Trade Center. And so when the Trade Center's collapsed, all those wires got severed, and so therefore knocked the New York Stock Exchange into complete darkness, and really knocked the country into darkness. Because what people need to understand is, once the New York Stock Exchange can't trade, once you can't trade the listed stocks of the New York Stock Exchange, you couldn't trade, you know, the derivatives, any underlying derivatives. You couldn't trade fixed income. You couldn't trade interest rates and currencies and commodities, because it's all tied together. And even though the NASDAQ, quote unquote, was still unfazed, because, you know, that was already an automated market.
It was in the
cloud.
There
was no plan. Was no plan B to, like, oh, we'll just trade on NASDAQ. Number one, there was no plan B. But number two, there were a half a dozen brokers that were located either in the Trade Center or right next door at World Financial Center that actually did get damaged. I mean, the ones in the Trade Center were certainly gone, but the ones in the World Financial Center were fully damaged. And they were names like Merrill Lynch and Oppenheimer and Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. And so, therefore, all those guys, all those offices had to be relocated somewhere else around the city or over in Jersey City, wherever they were, and they had to be also then reconnected into the system. And so for 6 days...
Kenny, let me ask you a question real quick. You said that futures and currencies also went through the New York Stock Exchange.
No, well, not that futures and currencies went through, but the minute you couldn't trade the underlying equity, you couldn't trade, you know, the whole country came to a standstill, right?
Right, right, okay.
And so the minute you couldn't trade stocks, nothing else, because it's all connected, right? Futures trade off of stock prices.
Currencies,
and
currencies trade? Currencies must have been out of control.
Well, currencies were out of control, but I don't trade currencies, right? And we don't trade currencies here. Currencies must have been out of control, because don't forget, currencies do trade around the world. So mm-hmm. they trade in Asia, they trade in Europe.
Right, that's what I was getting
to. They couldn't trade here. Right, and so it was a disaster. And so for 6 days, you know, first of all, that event then really brought to light, you know, here we were spending all this time on using technology to create this efficient 21st century market model. It was all about efficiency, and how can we use this computer to replace these five jobs and get rid of these five people and become efficient? That's what the whole argument was about up until 9/11. After 9/11, the story changed and the narrative changed, and it became, how do we use technology now to create stability and security in addition to efficiency? So efficiency was still part of the problem, the conversation, but now it was much more about secure, you know, making the system secure and stable. Because, listen, for 6 days, if you know, you may or may not remember this, the minute you can't trade, the minute you know, whether you're a retail investor and you've got, you know, your 401k money invested in the market, all of a sudden the market can't trade. You feel vulnerable, like, oh my God, I need my money, because you're getting nervous, right? And you can't get your money, which only causes you to become more fearful. Okay, well, think about the big asset managers in this country that are managing billions, if not trillions of dollars, and you think about the asset managers around the country, around the world, Asian managers, European managers, Latin American managers, that come to the United States every day and buy and sell and invest in U.S. stocks. They can't get their money either. And so you got investors and you got people all around the world that are starting now to panic. And for 6 days, this panic built, right? Because people were worried about what's the next shoe to drop. Was it going to be somewhere else in America? Was it going to be Chicago? Was it going to be Boston, L.A.? Was it going to be in Asia? Was it going to be in Europe? And so the fear was building around the world. And it was a very real fear. It was a very real fear, because the thought of not being able to get your money caused people a lot of anxiety, and certainly a lot of asset managers a lot of anxiety. And so very important that, you know, we had to get the New York Stock Exchange, we as a country had to get the New York Stock Exchange rewired. And so we shipped guys in from around the country almost immediately, you know, phone guys, cable guys, whatever. And they had to rewire this whole building to the outside world, and they had to rewire the outside world back into this building. They had to relocate those brokers that I said that were affected by the events of 9/11 to other places around the city, because you couldn't open the market on Monday and say to Merrill Lynch, oh, I'm sorry, you can't play. That ain't happening.
Right.
And so therefore, all those players had to be put back together. And think about this. Because think about the enormity of that event, and then you think about in 6 days, we had the whole place rewired, reconnected back to the outside world. We had to come down over the weekend on Saturday and Sunday. We had to test our phone lines. We had to test the computers. We had to make sure that they were going to work. Because
so
on that Monday,
let me ask you a question, Kenny. After the 11th, what was your first day back?
Well, so it was on Saturday, the 15th, I guess, right?
So you went in for like a test run, essentially, before the markets opened that Monday?
Yep. The exchange sent a notice out to everybody that worked on the floor that, you know, Saturday morning, I think it was at 10 o'clock, that we were all supposed to, you know, come back down to the floor, because we had to turn on your computers, you had to pick up your phones, you had to make sure you could dial out, you had to make sure people could dial in, you had to make sure the computers worked, that the data was coming through, right? Because on Monday they were getting ready to launch, because they had to. There was no choice. And so we came down on Saturday, and we came back again on Sunday.
Okay.
And I remember, you know, when I came down, I took the train into the city and I took the subway down. You could only go as far as Brooklyn Bridge, which is two stops away from Wall Street.
Right.
And you had to get out. The train stopped at Brooklyn Bridge. They didn't go past. And you had to walk from Brooklyn Bridge. And there were two circles of, like, National Guard and Army, right? Guys that were, you know, circling this whole downtown area. And in order to get through, you had to show, you know, you had to show your passport or your license, plus you had to show your building pass, and you had to do it multiple times in order to get through to get to the exchange. And then when you got in the exchange, you know, there was this really eerie sense. I'll never forget what it felt like to kind of be standing on the floor. You could still smell. The air outside still had that pungent odor of death, right? And by the way, that odor lasted for a good 3.5 months, because the fire burned in the belly of the Trade Center until November, because they couldn't get that fire out. And every day that odor would just rise, and depending on which way the wind was blowing, it either blew down over Lower Manhattan or blew out over the Hudson River into Jersey. But you could, the minute you stepped outside, you got hit with this smell, with this odor that was really, I can only describe it really as the odor of death, because what else was it? It wasn't the ocean, and it wasn't a bed of roses. It was death, really. And it was a really, really mentally challenging time to have to do that, to walk down the street, to smell that smell, to, you know, for everybody, not just for us, but anyone that was down here. It was a very mentally challenging time to do that. Anyway, so we did it on, we came on Saturday, we came on Sunday, and there were people who just didn't come back, and now some of them couldn't come back for obvious reasons. There were others that just chose not to come back because they just couldn't deal, right? They just couldn't come back.
So
they were either afraid, they didn't want to do it.
Kenny, what was that Monday? What was that Monday like for you, man? Like, walk me through getting there and how you felt and what that trading day was like.
Right. So Monday was a really, really emotional day. It was a difficult day all around. It was difficult emotionally. It was difficult physically. It was difficult financially. But, you know, we all showed up on Monday morning. You know, whoever came back, you know, whoever came back, and the place was filled up early, right? Because they wanted everyone to make sure that they got here. They didn't want people straggling in at 9 o'clock, and so, you know, they made sure that people were getting here by 7:30 in the morning, and making sure that they turned their phones on again and their computers on again and all that. But in addition, don't forget, on that Monday they had Hillary Clinton and Schumer, and they had policemen and firemen, and they had other government officials here, and they had, you know, guests in addition to just the people that worked there. And at the time, remember, there was still 5,500 people that worked on the floor of the exchange, separate from all these guests that were here. And so there was this. It was a sad day. But you know, it was a difficult, sad day when you got here, right? And I'll never forget that when, as we approached the 9:30 bell, you could feel 5,500 people in the room just go, you know, take a deep breath in and almost hold their breath, because at 9:30, when 9:29 and 55 seconds, when they rang that bell, the place was either going to, they were going to flip the switch, and the place was either going to light up or right. It wasn't. And right. If it didn't light up, if the computers didn't start to hum, if the tape didn't start to move, there would have been panic. And it wouldn't have been panic just in this country. By this point, there would have been global panic. For those reasons, I said that right. All these global investors who have money invested here in the United States couldn't access their money for 6 days. That's a big deal when you right. manage billions of dollars. That's constantly being moved around, right? And so, I can feel it. I can feel the whole place just hold their breath, and they rang the bell, and you could hear the whirl of the computers, right? You could hear them all fire up. You could all of a sudden see the tape started to move, and immediately the market came under immediate pressure. And the market came under pressure not because there was anything wrong with the economy or there was anything wrong with the macro data. The market came under pressure because people for 6 days that were so panicked wanted out. They said, right. Screw it. I want out. I don't want to own a piece of paper that says I own GE or Telephone or Coke or whatever. I want out.
Right.
So it was sell, and all these asset managers, you know, were getting hit with all these redemption and these sell orders from their clients. The market closed down that day on, I think it was down 600 or 700 points.
Probably a couple percent, right, at that point, right?
You know, we can go back and look. I think it was more than a couple of percent, actually. I think it was closer to 3%. We can go back and look, though, but one way or the other, all day long, and you could, you know, there was this sense of seriousness, because the floor was always a place that was so energetic and it was so exciting, and it was the personalities of the people that gave it its life. But on that day, everybody was like somber, right? There was really nothing to be happy about on that day. It was a somber, difficult day, and so people just did what they did. The usual joviality was just non-existent.
Right.
So the whole day went. The market came under pressure, and it was a difficult day. But at 3:59 and 45 seconds, when they started to ring the closing bell, and you know the closing bell and the opening bell are very, very ceremonious, right? I mean, it's one of the great things. It's one of the,
sure,
the iconic
yep.
things about that. But when they started to ring the closing bell, people just stood for a minute, just watching as the bell ticked to 4 o'clock. The minute the bell ticks to 4 o'clock, that's it. You know, trading is over. Pencils down. No more trading. And you could feel and hear those same 5,500 people almost exhale as if they were holding their breath the whole day. But it was at that moment, at 4 o'clock, when it became really emotional. Where people, you know, there were people that just started to cry, and they were crying because it was like you held those emotions in. You held them in. You were trying to be strong. You wanted to be strong. You wanted to prove. But you know, it's like now we made it through the day. The market did not fail. The technology did not fail. Yes, the tape was ugly. Yes, prices were ugly. Yes, the market was down. But in the end, it was a positive message, because
right.
we didn't fail, and you could feel the people in the room. Then people hugged each other. I mean, men cried, women cried. It was this really, really emotional experience, because it was a realization that we did it, right? That we had the place rewired and reconnected in 6 days, considering the enormity of what was just three blocks away from us, the disaster and the death that was just three blocks from this location. And yet we did it. And so the sense was, okay, bastards, you kicked us and you knocked us down and you brought us to our knees for 6 days, but guess what? Today we just stood up and now we're coming after you. That was exactly kind of the sense, right? It was absolutely the feeling, and it was an emotional rush because everyone looked at each other and said, you know, we did it. The place didn't fail. The technology didn't fail. We got it back up and running. Yes, it was ugly, but yes, you know, we traded stocks. People were able to access their money, and that was the good, right? That's what made it all worth it on that day. And then from there, the rest is history from there, because, you know, the market, you know, suffered for the next couple of days, had a very volatile time for the next whatever it was, a week and a half. And then it started to stabilize, you know, as it became clear that, okay, the market was working, it was functioning, you know, that it was not going to be the disaster that some people thought it was going to be.
Right.
And then the market started to repair itself. But it then became immediately shifted the narrative to, how do we now protect the nation?
Let me ask you a quick question. I'm sorry to interrupt you. But, you know, on the last podcast, you told us this incredible story about, you know, going out to breakfast with your friends and how you kind of narrowly avoided being in the Trade Center. You know, you also mentioned that you had lost a friend of yours, unfortunately. You know, what did you know at that point on Monday? Was it something you found out after? And that must have been emotionally just absolutely unbearable.
Well, I lost a lot of friends who worked, whether it was here on the exchange. There were three people that lost their lives, the brokers that were in the exchange. But there were people that worked in some of those brokerages, like at Cantor, and some of those other brokerages that didn't make it, that I certainly also knew as well. But I think the one you're talking about, are you talking about the guy who was actually on the plane, kid I went to high school with? Who was on the plane from Boston, who flew right through my – his plane flew right through my office building. Geez. I found out about him on Thursday of that week. So it happened on Tuesday, and on Thursday is when I found out about him. But the other people that I found out about, you found out about, you know, as we came back and you started talking to people. Because look, when I got home that day, I was like a zombie that day when I got home. And I sat on my couch, and I just sat on my couch for 3 days. I couldn't move. I didn't eat.
Right.
I mean, I just slept on the couch. I sat on the couch because I kept watching the TV, not able to fully even process what I was seeing and thinking of where I had been and how close I came and if this guy didn't come back to get me, and you know, all that stuff ran through my head. And then I got that call from my mother about the kid I went to high school with, who were family friends of ours, who was on the plane that flew through my office, which only, you know, that sent me over the edge on Thursday.
Right.
And then when you came back to work, you know, you started to hear other stories of people that, you know, people said, did you hear about this? Did you hear about Joe? Then you start to hear more stories, right? About people. Listen, I got a call at home on Sunday because I had I belong to a couple of industry organizations, right? Professional organizations.
Okay.
And in those directories, you know, you have an address book and it's got everyone's, you know, contact information. And my address was 2 World Trade Center, 55th floor. And so there were people who thought I had been killed that day because no one had heard from me and no one knew. No one had seen me. You know, when they started asking around, I didn't see them. You know, and all the confusion, people don't remember who they saw, who they didn't see.
Right.
And so I was just at home because I was numb. And when I finally got a phone call on the Sunday afternoon, it was from a very dear friend of mine. And he called and my wife answered the phone. And he wasn't sure because she answered the phone. And she said to her, no one's heard from Kenny. And she said, he's been sitting here on the couch since he got home because he just can't understand it. You know, he couldn't process it. But he said, you know, he was glad to hear that I was sitting on the couch because the word was that I had gotten killed, right?
Right.
And so that also was, you know, that also was a difficult time for me to, you know, because I almost did, right? If that guy didn't come back to get me for breakfast, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. Right. Absolutely not be having this conversation. And so I get it. You see, and it's so funny because even now when I talk about that, here it is 16 years later, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm good with this, I can do it. But the emotions immediately well up in me again.
Sure.
as I think about certain moments of that time in history and my own feelings, and the feelings come back, right? So just then I could feel myself getting getting emotional again, right? Talking about the fact that people thought I was dead and they were afraid to call my wife, and you know, the way the word spread like that. But one way or the other, it was, and after that, it was a difficult time. I went to a lot of funerals. I went to a lot of wakes, right? People that I knew who didn't make it. And I went to a lot of them. And also, the other thing that people need to understand, and I'm not sure I might have said this the last time, it's the people who you don't know, but you know. So, for instance,
right.
I would be on the 5 o'clock train every day from Westchester County. I'd take the train into Grand Central. I'd get to Grand Central at 5:30. I'd get on the subway. I'd get downtown to Wall Street at 10 minutes of 6. I'd walk up to the coffee cart every morning between 10 minutes of 6 or 6 o'clock, something in there, right? And every morning I saw you and I saw Mary and I saw some other guy, people who I didn't know, but I knew because we all were on the same schedule, coming from different places, and every day we would cross our paths at the coffee guy, right? At 6 o'clock in the morning, we'd all come walking up, and everyone would get a cup of coffee, and everyone would say, "Hey, how are you? Do you have a nice weekend?" Just a little conversation. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know you from a hole in the wall, but I knew you every single day I saw you.
Everybody has those people. You see them at lunch. You see them when you grab your coffee. You see them smoking a cigarette outside, right?
But it was the realization that after that event, I didn't see you anymore.
Right.
And I didn't see Mary anymore. And I didn't see that guy Bill anymore. Now, did they get killed that day, or did they just decide they couldn't come back? I don't know the answer to the question because I only knew them from getting a cup of coffee with them every day. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know them personally, but
right.
yet it was but I have to tell you, it's a really, really sad thing. Like the realization that you sit around and you go, oh my God, like I'll never see these people again. And not that there was a deep relationship, but there was a relationship.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it wasn't happening on TV for you, you know?
No. And so and so there were a lot of emotions that were just, you know, and they ran around for months and months and months. And, you know, at one point I had a very difficult time, kind of like that survivor's remorse, right, that they talk about, right?
Sure, yep.
Because I think to myself, you know, you and I were in the same place. You and I had young wives and young kids and young families, and you didn't get to go home that day. You know, you got caught in the rubble
right.
and got killed. And I should have. I was there. It wasn't like I was on the other side of town. It wasn't like I was uptown. I was in the building.
Right.
And so why did that guy have a bug up his ass that day to come back and get me? What was it that had him so set on making sure I left that building? And I can't answer that question, and nor can he, by the way. And, he just said, I have no idea. It's just what we wanted, right? We wanted you to come to breakfast that day. And so if he had been a good employee, he would have listened to you. And I said, dude, I can't go with you. You know, go by yourself and I'll meet you there. But he just looked at me and said, no, you're coming with us. We want you to come to breakfast. And so, you know, I thank him every single day.
Yeah. I know that.
So now we get.
Go ahead, Kenny.
No, so now we get through that. We get on the other side of 9/11, and you know, for the next 10 years, I mean, certainly that whole space, that whole acreage over there on the west side, was a disaster, right? It was a big hole. It was ugly. It was just a reminder of the tragedy and the horrific event that took place there, because there was a lot of internal fighting in the city and with surviving families, and what did they want it to look like, and who's going to build it, and you know, who was happy with the plan and who wasn't happy with the plan. And so that went on for 10 years, the back and forth about how to redevelop that site to bring honor to the people that lost their lives there. And if you haven't been there, I suggest the next time to anybody who listens to this podcast, they come to New York, that, you know, it's a place you have to go, because today it's actually I will say they did a spectacular job with it. The memorial part of it are those two infinity pools, which are the footprint of the actual buildings, which are really spectacular, and they're peaceful, and it's very much a memorial and a graveyard, absolutely. But it is so beautifully done, especially now in spring and summer when it's all in bloom. It doesn't feel like death anymore. It's very somber, yes, like any memorial is, but it doesn't feel like death anymore. And then you go to the museum is tough to take. The museum is underground, right on that same acreage. It takes you about 2.5 hours, I guess, to go through the museum and see what you see. And the interesting thing about the museum is, because it was so recent, this event, is that, you know, there's live video footage, right? You see the video footage of the helicopters. You see the video footage of people jumping. You see the video footage of the planes, you know, hitting the building and the resulting explosion in the with all its intensity, right? And you hear the voicemails, and you hear husbands on the phone telling their wives how much they love them, or wives on the phone telling their kids how much they love them. And they knew that those people knew that they weren't getting out. A lot of those were Cantor Fitzgerald voicemails and other voicemails from other people that were way high in the building. And you knew, you know, when you listen to those voicemails, those people are gone forever. And those words that you hear were the last words that they ever spoke, right? And it's tough to take, but I think you have to do it. For me, I couldn't go back. It opened. I just couldn't get myself to go there. And then it was open for about 2 or 3 years. And I had relatives in from Rome who came to New York, and all they wanted to do was go to the museum. And I said, listen, I'll take you down there, but I am not going in. You can go in. I'll tool around outside. I cannot go in. And so they begged me to go. And I thought to myself, you know something, I've been having a real tough time with this. Maybe I should try it. What's the worst that's going to happen? I'll get emotional. Maybe I'll start to cry, but I can leave. I'm not going to be stuck down there. I could always leave if that happened to me. But I went. I ended up going with them, and I will tell you, it was cathartic, right? Because it almost took the memories and the ghosts and the you know, all that negative stuff that I had been holding in, and it finally put it all in its place for me, right? So actually going for me was quite cathartic, and you know, I've been one more time since, because I went with another set of guests that came that wanted to go, so I did go again. I wouldn't necessarily. It's tough for me. It's tough, right? So I've been there. I could go there. Could I go there again? Yes. Do I want to run right there and go there again tomorrow? I don't, because my memory is very different. But somebody from the outside, somebody from away from here that comes, they need to go because they need to understand what really happened.
And there's, you know, what's really interesting about 9/11, and you're talking about the museum, is, you know, this was really one of the first major, one of the first major catastrophic events that happened in an era where we had not only, digital cable and regular cable. You know, of course, you can go back and you can see old newspaper footage and old grainy footage from the 50s and from the 60s and from the 40s and you know, at the end of World War II and things like that. This was really the first major, like, catastrophic nationwide event that we had that, like you said, was captured not only by, you know, 50 or 100 worldwide cable news networks, but also, you know, from every which way and angle on the internet. And one of the fascinating things that I've done over the last 10 years has been just going back and listening to many different takes on 9/11 as it was occurring from different broadcast stations, from different, you know, Howard Stern did an incredible broadcast that was 3 hours long. He actually broadcast through the events as they were happening. And there's a million different, if you go on the web, I mean, or you go on like YouTube, there's a million different mediums that you can go and actually listen to their take on the events as they unfold. And that's really unprecedented. I mean, we've never really had an event like that where you're able to look back on it from so many different angles.
Right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that's why when you go to the museum, you see all that, right? All that is very, I don't mean to say it like this, but it is live and in color. It's
sure.
a complete color, and you see it. You see it from, the first plane, because it was so unexpected, you see it. It's very brief, right? It's very quick. All of a sudden, you see this explosion. You go, what the hell was that? But when the second plane comes around, it's almost as if you're watching it in slow motion, even though you're not.
Right, right.
When you're sitting there in the middle museum, it almost feels like it's slow motion, and you watch as the plane just goes diagonally through, from the west side to the east side of the second tower, taken out from, 58 to 78 because of the wingspan. It took out 20 floors when it went in at an angle, right?
And the view of the second plane is when you get the – it took a while for this footage to come out, but the view of the second plane going in, you have a much better – I mean, it's happening right in front of you, and you're watching it, but it seems very surreal.
Well, it's surreal because after the first plane hit, all of a sudden there were these cameramen and helicopters all flying around. So they were all there when the second plane came in, right?
Right.
And from the last when I told you the last time, I was on the phone with my wife right before the second plane hit because I was trying to ask her to turn on the TV to tell me what was going on because I needed her to explain to me what I wasn't seeing, right?
Where's home? Westchester?
Home is in Westchester. And I told you, when she picked up the phone, she's crying, and I'm still not putting it together why she's crying, because I still don't really understand what's happened.
Right.
And I was on the phone with her for about a minute, and all of a sudden, she starts screaming into the phone, because you're absolutely right. There you are watching as the second plane kind of turns, makes that wide turn over the Hudson River right into the building.
Right.
And she still thinks I'm in the building. Now, she doesn't realize that I'm not in the building, but she still thinks I'm in.
Oh, my God.
And so she's screaming into the phone. And now I'm saying to her, Evelyn, why are you screaming? Why are you screaming? And all of a sudden, there was this massive explosion when the plane hit. What you have to understand is that the second plane hit going west to east, so the explosion came out the east side of the building. The exchange is on the east side of the Trade Center. And so because it was lower in the building versus high up, the explosion was much closer to the ground, and so therefore it reverberated across the three blocks between the Trade Center and the New York Stock Exchange. Now here I am standing on the floor of the exchange in the corner in my booth on the phone, and I not only heard it, but you could feel the building actually shook when that plane hit that. This building actually shook when the plane hit the second tower. And that's when I started screaming back at my wife because all she's doing is screaming. She's not even talking. She's just screaming and crying. And then the alarm went off here at the exchange, right? It was probably 30 seconds after that happened that they sounded the alarm at the exchange, because now it was very apparent that this wasn't a one-off. This wasn't just a mistake.
Right.
And when you think of America and you think of capitalism and you think of trying to bring us to our knees, the New York Stock Exchange is everything you think about. It represents everything we are in terms of a capitalistic society. And in terms of a democratic society, this is it. And so they immediately sounded the alarm at the exchange and took everybody out. And they took us out the east side of the building. They wouldn't let us walk out the front door because that was going towards Trade Center.
Were you at the exchange when you were talking to your wife?
Yeah, so I was, I had
you were upstairs
down from
having breakfast.
And I was in the corner. Now, my wife didn't realize that because she was so upset that she couldn't hear me when I told her where I was, right? And so we left the exchange. I walked out on the east side of the building on Broad Street. And then I walked up and I walked east on Wall Street towards the East River. And it was only when I got in front of 40 Wall Street, which is actually the Trump Tower, where you could see the top halves of the Trade Center. That's where you had a good shot of the Trade Center. That's where you could see them from, right? And it was only then when I stood out on the street and I turned around and I looked that I could ultimately see what everyone else had already been seeing, right?
Right.
The buildings were completely engulfed in flames. And even though I couldn't see that it was you or that it was, your business partner, I could see from standing in front of 40 Wall Street, you could see images of these falling objects, which were really the people that were choosing to either burn to death or jump. And so I couldn't see that it was you, but you could, because it was such a clear day outside, you could see images of just these, these falling objects and that of which were the people, right? And I remember standing there in front of 40 Wall Street, and I remember just wiping my eyes, trying to process what I was even seeing, because I couldn't even I couldn't even imagine that this was happening. It was surreal, like you said, and you're sitting going, like, this has to be a movie. Like, you couldn't even begin to process it. And I remember standing there, and then you know, we were being pushed further east, right? Move, kind of thing. And so we started to walk. I walked down to the East River, and then I walked north because I live north of the city, and I was fully prepared to walk home. Certainly, I'm not going down in any subway. Not that you were going to take the subway. Right. They shut the subway system down right away. And I started walking north, and I was walking along Water Street, which is just underneath the FDR Drive, and I got up to Chinatown, which is just the next bridge up, right? So it goes to Brooklyn Bridge and then the Manhattan Bridge, and right. Manhattan Bridge is right in Chinatown. So we were right there at about 10 o'clock, right? Now, the building had hit at 9:01, and it collapsed at 10:04 or whatever, right? I mean, about an hour and 4 minutes after it got hit is when the building collapsed. And the first building collapsed, though, was the building I was in, because that's the one that got hit lower, and so there was so much weight above it from the floors above it caused that building to collapse first.
Let me ask you a question real quick, Kenny, before we go into the collapse, because I want to ask you about that. But when you were still at the Exchange, you know, it had to be a really weird set of circumstances, because here's people like your wife and people around the world, people like me, you know, I'm sitting in my dorm room at the time and we're watching it on television, and there's a narrative, there's commentators, there's people saying, you know, at this point it looks like it's a terrorist attack, or it looks like this is more than just an accident. When was that moment for you? Because you were there. Was it when the alarm went off at the Exchange? Was it the second explosion? When did you start to go from confused to understanding?
Well, go ahead. So that's a great question, and I'll tell you when it happened for me, because here, you know, like, my wife kept saying, they flew a plane. I kept saying, who is they? Who are you talking about? And then she was repeating what she was hearing on TV, you know, Al-Qaeda. Who the fuck is Al-Qaeda? I had, you know, wasn't like, you know, and for me it was...
Nobody knew back then. Nobody knew, right?
So for me, it was confusing because I didn't know who Al Qaeda was. I didn't. You couldn't process and understand it. So
right.
Then I had to hang up the phone on her, and we walked outside, right? And as we get down to the corner of Wall and Water. Water Street is the main thoroughfare that goes north and south. That's where all the cars are, the cabs, all that stuff. Because on Wall Street, you know, it had been there was more like a walking space, right? There weren't that many cars around. But the cars down on Water Street were all the cabs and all these cars, and it was a beautiful day. But the traffic came to a standstill, right? It was like a traffic jam. But all the windows were down. People that were in the car, they had their windows down, and it was like every radio station was tuned to the same station. And as you're walking on the street, you could hear, coming out of the cars, you could just hear the reporter repeating and repeating and repeating what had just happened, and the speculation that it was terrorism, the speculation that it was this thing called Al-Qaeda, the speculation about who was behind it, right? You could hear it. And that's when it became, as I'm walking down the street, I'm trying to process, you know, who are these people and why would this happen? But as you hear it, as you walk and you heard from one car to the next, you started to put it together that certainly this was not just a one-off, that this was an attack on the country. And then it really wasn't until, you know, it wasn't really until I got home and I sat in the couch and I just watched the news over and over and over like everyone else did, that you started to become really aware of.
Really? So it was that much later for you?
Yeah, it was. Well, for me, I got home that day at about 3 o'clock, 2:30, 3 o'clock, somewhere around there. And I remember just going in my house and sitting on the couch.
That's
because up until then, remember when we were walking all the way. We walked
right, and there was
downtown all the way to Grand Central.
No smartphones, no internet. Right.
It wasn't like I was sitting watching. I was walking. And so I kept hearing, right? You heard, and there was certainly speculation and people around you talking. But until I got home and I sat on my couch and I just watched the news. And I tell you, I went in my house, I sat on my couch. I just sat on that couch for 3 days. I didn't move for 3 days. I just couldn't even get off the couch. Do you know what I mean? I was stuck to the TV.
Yeah, it was it's so strange to hear you say that it wasn't until 2 or 3 o'clock that you realized that, because, you know, obviously you were much closer to it than I was.
Yeah.
I was in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and I was in college at the time, and I remember, you know, they moved everybody to the student union and they were playing the news there, but it was 9:45 or 10 o'clock when they first started to speculate that it was a terrorist attack. So, you know,
I mean, listen, there was all the speculation and I heard it. I just couldn't process it. Like, it wasn't
making sense to me.
I didn't know. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was too surreal.
And unthinkable, right? Yeah. Yep.
And so, and don't forget, we were walking, right? I wasn't just sitting watching it. I was just walking, and people were like drones, right? I mean, people were just walking. There wasn't like a lot of chatter or talk. You could hear all day, the whole ride, the whole walk up to Grand Central. You could hear the sirens and the ambulances and the police sirens. You could just hear them, right? And that was like the background noise. But then almost in a weird way, you could hear a pin drop at the same time. Do you know what I mean? That's how surreal it was. And I remember, you know, I walked to Midtown with four other guys, and you know, there wasn't a lot of talking even amongst us. We were just walking, right? There wasn't even like a lot of talking because everyone was trying to process it. And anyway, so
you get up to Midtown. Where were you when the first building collapsed?
I was in Chinatown when the first building collapsed, and that's when, you know, right by the Brooklyn Bridge. And so what had happened was when the first building started to collapse, you didn't know what it was. It almost sounded like there were planes above and like someone was going to drop bombs on us. And then it sounded like the streets were exploding, like they were going to blow up the subways. And I thought to myself, I turned around and I looked at one of the guys and I said, they're blowing up the goddamn subways. Like I was fully expecting to see the streets of New York start to blow up because that's what it felt like. But what it was the rumbling was the collapse of the first tower. And from where we were sitting in Chinatown, I turned and I looked south and I had a perfect view of the trade centers. And as that rumbling, as that noise is happening, I'm watching live as the building and all the smoke and everything, you know, as the building collapses and all that smoke comes up. And I remember thinking to myself, that's my goddamn building. Like, that's the building I was in that just collapsed. And what's really important for people, and I think I said this the last time, but the reason I don't think I would have been here, because had I stayed in that building, had you not come back to get me that day and I stayed in that building, I would have been, when the first building got hit, they sounded the alarm in both buildings, and so I would have been evacuating the second building. Even though the second building hadn't gotten hit yet, they started to evacuate. But when you evacuated, you got to get on the stairs, not the elevators. So I would have been the other people on the 55th floor who I know who survived had gone from 55 to 25. So in 12 minutes, between hit one and hit two, it was 12 minutes. In 12 minutes, they went down 30 floors from 55 to 25. After when the building got hit, they were in the 25th floor stairwell. When the building got hit, the explosion happened. The pandemonium started. People getting thrown all off the stairs. You know, everyone trying to regroup. It took them from 9:01 to 9:59 to get out of the building. So it took them nearly an hour to go from 25 to the plaza, to the lobby level, right? So I think to myself, okay, where would I have been? I would have been there on the 25th, the 26th floor, somewhere in that stairwell, at that level probably. But I don't know, in the next 54 minutes, would I have gotten stuck behind somebody? Would I have helped somebody? Don't forget, because now the firemen started to come up the stairs as people were trying to go down the stairs, which is what clogged it up, right?
Right, yeah.
And so I think to myself, where would I have been? And would I have gotten out in that 55 minutes? Would I have stepped out onto the plaza and been so traumatized by seeing the dead bodies and the falling bodies and the debris everywhere and the smoke and the smell, that would I have been so traumatized that I just stood there and then 2 minutes later the building would have collapsed on me anyway, which is what I think would have happened, right?
So I don't think
I would have actually made it out. I think I would have been like at the lower levels, but I think I would have gotten caught. I absolutely do. And so I remember sitting there when I saw the building collapse, thinking to myself, oh my God, that the first building to go was the second building to get hit, which was the building I was in.
Right.
And then 10 minutes later, the first building collapsed, right?
That's like 40 blocks away, Chinatown, or 30 blocks away?
Yeah, Chinatown's on, Canal Street. So, but I was on the east side, right? The trade centers are on the west side. Canal Street is only the west side of Canal Street was only, I don't know, maybe it was a mile from the trade centers. But since I was on the east side, I was probably a couple of miles away. But it didn't. I didn't get caught in the smoke. I didn't get caught in that cloud. But you could absolutely feel, because even lower Manhattan rumbled. Like, it felt like an earthquake. It felt like they were blowing up the streets, or it felt like an earthquake was happening when both those buildings fell. And But you know, and after that, you know, you're just walking, and you're just saying to yourself, I can't even believe what I just saw. Like I can't even process what I just saw. Like it was so difficult to realize that had actually happened, right?
Right.
And so it was tough, but you know, and like I said, some people couldn't come back. Some people chose not to come back, and the ones that did. And for the most part, you know, most of the people came back. I bet you that, well, there were three people that got killed that worked on the floor, and then there were probably, I don't know, maybe 60 or 70 other people that just said, I just can't do it. You know, they just can't do it. I didn't want to come back. They just didn't want to do it. And they didn't. And one way or the other. You know, so we move on from there. And so the markets, not that I'm downplaying it at all. I'm not. But you have to move on, right? And so it was after that event that the narrative in this country said, okay, here we are, the largest developed market in the world, the biggest market center in the world, and here we are with this nation dependent upon a single location in a building located in downtown Manhattan run by the same 5,500 people every single day to make it work. And it worked beautifully. It worked fine. There was nothing wrong with it until this event happened and it made everybody realize, like, what are we doing? How can we can never put ourselves in this position again? And so the narrative then changed. How do we use technology to create security and stability versus just efficiency? So today, as a result of that event, there are 11 exchanges. The New York Stock Exchange is the only physical exchange. The other 10 exchanges are virtual. They trade in the cloud. You can't touch them, feel them, see them, visit them. You can't do anything. They don't exist, right? The servers that run them are located all over the country. Because if they were located in downtown Manhattan, all you do is blow up downtown Manhattan. You bring the place to its knees again. So now they're located in California and Colorado and Michigan and Massachusetts and Florida. You'd have to blow up the whole goddamn country in order to bring the citizens to its knees. And if you do that, who gives a shit where Boeing is trading? Because we got much bigger issues, right? And so it may get ugly if they blow this building up tomorrow. Is it a tragedy? It's absolutely a tragedy. I get it. But the country is no longer held hostage because the virtual exchanges, the cloud-based exchanges, will continue. They're all connected. They're all interconnected. So it'll continue to trade. Look, prices will get ugly for sure, but if you want to make a sale, you would be able to make a sale, right? Versus in 9/11, you couldn't buy or sell. You didn't have that luxury. And as a result, today you would have the ability, if something like that ever happened again and they blew this building up or they damaged this building, it would be a tragedy. But the country's no longer held hostage, so therefore global investors are no longer held hostage the way they were. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You create some redundancy, you create some fail safes, right?
And so that's what we have today. We have a very fractured market center because, you know, today you can buy General Mills in any one of 11 exchanges here at the New York Stock Exchange, which is the primary listing, and any one of the other 10 exchanges that exist. You can also buy and sell it in any one of the 50 or 60 dark pools that exist, which are a whole nother conversation we should have about dark pools.
We definitely should have that conversation. That should be our next podcast.
Because dark pools, you know, certainly they were born out of the events in 9/11. They were starting to be discussed prior to 9/11, but after 9/11, it was really gave birth to the dark pools because again they were cloud based, they were alternative venues that were not a physical exchange that you could then trade at, and so it's a very, very fractured marketplace today. And so as a result of all that technology and all the changes that took place, the New York Stock Exchange is a shadow of its former self in the sense of the 5,500 people that work here are now less than 300. We're trading more stocks today with less people because of all the technology we use, right? So it's a different marketplace. The five trading rooms that made up the floor of the New York Stock Exchange back in 2001 are back to the original main room of the New York Stock Exchange. Everything we traded in five rooms now trades all in one room with the assistance of 300 people, brokers and specialists, and the technology, right?
Right.
And so it's different. The open outcry is gone. There's no more open outcry. If people watch old movies, they're going to see, you know, what used to be the open outcry, which I thought was really the greatest thing in the world. It was the most amazing place, the energy in the place, the energy of the people. It was the most amazing place. If for those people who couldn't see it, you know, they're never going to see it now because it's forever gone.
Well, there's two really good things that you can watch. There was a PBS special called Open Outcry that they ran in like the 90s that was really awesome. It's like a 45-minute documentary. You can get it on YouTube. The other one, there was a movie called Floored Into the Pit, which was about, you know, the open outcry pits, the remaining ones. And this was early 2000s, but the computers had already started to kind of make their way in and nudge out certain pits.
But anyway, so what we have today is certainly a more robust, stable, secure marketplace than it was. There's no doubt about it. But you know, as a small business owner, because that's really what I am, right? I don't work for Goldman or First Boston or Morgan Stanley. I work for myself, basically.
Right.
You know, under the guise of O'Neill Securities, which is a member firm. But I have the local 7-Eleven, right? Versus Goldman Sachs would be, you know, the Lord and Taylor, I guess, right?
Or the big
firm. And so, you know, for a lot of the guys down here, you know, the technology wiped a lot of people out, for sure. Other people just gave up and said, I'm not interested in doing it this way. I don't want to do it anymore, so they don't. You know, Goldman Sachs went from having, you know, 120 people on the floor to two. They've got two people down here that now represent the interests of Goldman when, you know, in the height of the season, there might have been 120 or 130 people.
Right, right.
You know, First Boston, the same thing, 45 people. When I ran the floor for Salomon Brothers back in 95, 96, and 97, I had 49 people who worked for me, brokers and clerks. And, you know, today, there's two people left at what is now Citibank because you know, Salomon Brothers got back in 97 got gobbled up by Citibank, and so today there's, you know, two people left. You know, First Boston doesn't have a single representative on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. They've completely automated the whole process.
Yet CNBC probably has 15 representatives on the floor.
Yeah. And so, you know, that Post 9 where you see CNBC every day, that used to be a trading post, you know, but since the Post was no longer needed because the technology created so much efficiency, CNBC and the exchange made a deal with each other, and they created this on floor studio, which is in the shape of a post, you know, kind of that horseshoe shape. And so they get lots of use out of it, and so they broadcast live from here all morning and then all afternoon, and so it's worked out great. But you know, it's a different place. You know, and I do a lot of CNBC, so I love the fact that they're here because, A, I love to do the market commentary stuff, and
right.
I love to be on with them, and I think some of them are really dynamic, and so, like, it's great.
Oh, listen, man, I know that you are short on time today, you told me earlier, but I do, will you come back on and talk about dark pools for the next one?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Will you come back on and tell me about it? Because that's one I'm genuinely interested in. I would love to hear your take on kind of how that started and what it's blossomed into. But maybe in a couple of weeks we can get back together and we can talk about that.
I that's one of my favorite things to talk about because I think, you know, at the time I understand why they were born and what they provided. There's, in my opinion, there's absolutely zero reason for them to exist today other than they're big money makers for all the big firms, right? Because
right.
all the big Goldman's and the UBS's, they all own these dark pools and they make a ton of money in them. And so therefore, you know, they all run down to Washington, they hire lobbyists on both sides of the fence, they sleep with, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, they make sure everybody's happy, and then they keep what they got. Now, I get it. Okay, I get it. But as long as people understand it, that's the way it works. I think the market is way too fractured. I don't think dark pools should exist at all anymore. I think the markets are built for the public marketplace, and public, you know, lit public markets are a stronger market overall, in my opinion. When you have a lot of volume trading in the dark where you can't see it,
right.
you can't talk to anybody, you never know it's trading, you're really weakening, in my opinion, you're weakening the broader market.
It's not a public market.
The public market, right. You're weakening the public market. And that's a whole conversation that we can have, but I don't have enough time to do it now. But, you know, I have very definite opinions on that.
I don't doubt that. I do not doubt that, Brother Kenny.
Anyways, right, but listen, yeah, in a couple of weeks, I'm happy to do it again with you.
All right, awesome, man. I know a lot of people will be looking forward to that, and myself included. But listen, I want to just quickly thank you for coming on today. Like I said, I know you're a little bit short on time, but so many people have been asking for you to come back on and to recant those events, which I know were must have been an extremely emotional time. And we'll pick it up where we left off next time we meet, all right?
Perfect.
All right, Kenny.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
Thanks so much, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the one, the only, Kenny Polcari, live and in the flesh, although not really, patched in through a phone, but, you know. more incredible story. I actually said to him before he came on today, I was like, yeah, let's run from 9/11 to the 2008 crash, because, oh, fuck, there goes the thing. And I'm sure you heard the leaf blower in the background also, too. On one hand, I was pissed off that they were doing that. On the other hand, I was really happy that my HOA money was going somewhere. So yeah, I just decided to let the guy go. I almost wanted to shout out the window during the middle of the podcast. Take that thing to the other side of the fucking house. But yeah, I would love to have Kenny back on. Man, I got a million questions about dark pools I'd like to ask him. But it's crazy. We just got so hung up on 9/11 that we never really even advanced through the chronology of things like we wanted to. So hopefully we'll have him on back again. And Thursday I should have Christine Richard on as well to talk a little bit. She just did an awesome AMA on the subreddit that is r/anti-MLM. Christine Richard is the person who brought the Herbalife idea to Bill Ackman, and she did a lot of the research. She's a extremely talented researcher. She's a very sweet woman. She has done some fantastic investigative reporting. So I'm really stoked to be talking to her later on this week. But for now, we are going to call it a day. Kenny Polcari came on. He came on energized. And you guys went for the thrill ride with him. And thank you guys so much for tuning in. And I will catch up with you later this week. Peace.